Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to COVID-19 and lung cancer, what we know, what we don't know, and what it all means to patient care. We're really excited to have an outstanding faculty here today to discuss this. Here's where we're heading today. We want to chat a little bit about sort of the personal impact of COVID, what it's been like, particularly in the epicenters, and we're fortunate to have Leisha Sequist and Naya Rizvi from Boston and New York, where a tremendous amount of COVID was seen. And then we're going to get into the meat of the program and try to distill out some of the recommendations from our faculty and others about management of oncology patients in general nowadays who don't have COVID, and also management of the patient who is known to have COVID. And finally, we'll talk about some ongoing issues moving forward. First, just maybe kind of a little bit of a professional, thinking back to the old days a few months ago when we were all together. I still feel that same vibe, you know, when I still talk to the faculty virtually. Nair, maybe you can talk a little bit. New York, of course, I think was the first major epicenter really to go through some of the challenges that we're going to talk about today. Can you talk a little bit in terms of what the experience was like for you and your team? And any advice you have, you know, we're looking at other areas of the country now, Houston, et cetera, who may be facing that kind of situation. Any comments about kind of what you went through there, Nair?
I think that, I think it thankfully for, you know, people going through it now, if they're in states where it may be surging, it's at least there's testing in place now. I think when we were going through it, there was no testing available at all. So you were kind of flying in the dark for the first few weeks without knowing, you know, who was a potential, positive patients versus not. And I think once the testing became available in a more real-time way, we were able to, kind of manage it a little bit better. But I think that the testing is really key for patients that are going through it now, and limiting exposure, for patients that are positive, for patients who are, that are coming in through all of this. We really restricted it to just the patient and not any family members, unless they physically needed somebody to assist their transportation. For patients that we are treating now who are COVID positive, we have an isolated sort of area room where we do that. So we're not, limiting their care. Obviously, all of the elective biopsies and procedures, were held, which made it, challenging for new patients. We shifted our practice, for patients, they mostly didn't want to come into New York City, right? And so if they needed a scan to assess their disease, if they're on observation or on targeted therapies where they didn't need any intravenous treatment, they would have it locally, send us the CDs, we'd upload them and have them read here. For patients who were receiving, pembrolizumab every 3 weeks, there's now a label for pembrolizumab to be given every 6 weeks. So we tried to shift as many of our patients as we could to an every 6 week schedule to minimize their exposure. So, it was an ordeal, and I think that we're continuing the vigilance in terms of our monitoring of our patients and testing. Things are, and also, sort of limiting, patients in the waiting room and sort of staggering clinic visits more, more. So we're maintaining the distancing for patients. So it's been hard.
So we'll pursue a lot of the granularity of sort of many of the things that you just commented on or introduced. Leisha, we had the pleasure of working with Kelly Goodwin She actually went on one of our nursing programs, and she actually was on one of our podcasts, our Oncology Today podcast. And she's a nurse practitioner at MGH, was involved in setting up a, you guys set up a separate unit for COVID. I didn't really realize until I started talking to the MGH people how much of a problem COVID was, particularly in that area. Again, Lisha, in your talk, and I should say, I met with each one of the faculty separately, recorded an extensive presentation, which we're going to be posting the next week or so to put this whole program together. And Lisha and I are going into a lot more detail, but maybe you can kind of provide a little bit of an overview, Lisha, of kind of this new unit that you all set up and, you know, kind of what happened there.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Neil. I think at Mass General, we actually did have quite a large volume of COVID patients, the most in Massachusetts, went through our hospital, and that was a little bit just because of geography. The city in Massachusetts that was really the epicenter and by far the hardest hit was Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is just right next door to our hospital. And so, you know, at Mass General, we had to quickly transition over a matter of just a couple weeks our ICU capacity from our baseline of 119 up to a capacity of 238. So really so many different practitioners within the hospital were pulled from their typical duties and asked to do other things to help with both the inpatients and the outpatients with COVID. And of course, taking care of cancer patients who didn't have COVID but still needed cancer care was still a top priority, as I'm sure it was in New York as well. And I think one general piece of advice that I would give to those of you watching who are seeing cases rise in your area, or maybe in the future cases will rise in your area, is that it just takes an incredible amount of flexibility and grace as COVID surges in your area. You will probably be asked to do things as a physician that you're not maybe thrilled about. And to take care of patients, we all have to dig deep and find a way to do that. Your patients are also being asked to do things. You know, they're living with cancer, and that is enough to have on anyone's plate. And now they're being asked to change their plans for reasons that are outside of anyone's hands. And people get frustrated and rightfully upset with that. So just trying to take it one day at a time and give everyone a little bit of grace, I think is helpful advice.
You know, Nair, one of the concerns that we've heard people talk about is the difficulty in accessing treatment, patients' reluctance to go for treatment, ER's reluctance to see patients. A few days ago, we had a webinar with Dr. Rich Stone from Dana-Farber. He's a physician in chief. He was talking about a patient who they thought had acute leukemia, turned out actually had pancreatic cancer, been bumped around from ER's doctors. Everyone didn't want to come in, basically came in pre-terminal and died within a couple of days from pancreatic cancer. Nair, any comment about that phenomena, the delay in receiving care that cancer patients are experiencing now?
Yeah, I'm sure we don't really, understand the full scope of it because, things are happening where patients are staying at home and not seeking care for symptoms. I think in New York, there was a significant increase in the number of people who died in their sleep, because just in the general population, because they just weren't, addressing that chest pain they may have been having or something else. So I think we probably just, when we hear about it, then, we have patients that are sick and we tell them to come in the hospital and they refuse. I mean, it's a little bit, difficult, but, I think we just don't know how extensive a problem it was because we just don't know about them.
So again, before we drill down further into some of these specifics, just to give you a little bit of flair, what I've been hearing as I talk to people, on our podcast series, one of the people I sought out right away was Tom Lynch, and your colleague from MGH, Lisha, had a stint there in industry and then decided to come back into academia and drops into Seattle and Fred Hutch in the middle of February, just as COVID was, that was the, really the first epicenter. So we'll talk a little bit about his thoughts, and particularly as it relates to future research. And of course, I had to ask him about the Adora trial, but we'll talk about that later. Another thing I just want to bring out before we kind of get started is this whole arena that we're seeing of the use of oncologic agents to treat COVID. And one of the docs that we work with, Jeff Sharman from U.S. Oncology in Eugene, Oregon, was on one of our programs and actually shared with us a paper that he ended up publishing a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you all saw it, but to me, really an amazing paper looking at acalabrutinib for 2 weeks, 2 weeks of acalabrutinib, a pretty benign, you know, BTK inhibitor, to treat people with ARDS from COVID. You know, only 19 patients, but, you know, pretty exciting. Just kind of curious, Nyer, we see IL-6 trials, JAK trials. Any thoughts, Nyer, about using oncologic drugs to deal with some of the immune consequences of COVID, Nyer?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have a trial that, you know, we're doing right now with an IL-8 antibody, which is underway, and it's, you know, it's been remarkable. Has been how quickly, you know, both pharma and academia have regulatory agencies, IRBs, have sort of gotten together to work collaboratively at a pace which is, you know, sort of lightning fast to be able to get these trials underway. I think we got this IL-8 trial open, you know, within a couple of weeks here at Columbia. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of different repurposing of cancer agents. Also, you know, the data that was sort of a press release around sort of the, you know, the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine, which showed, you know, some reasonable antibody response in a small group of patients. I mean, BioNTech was primarily a cancer company focusing on cancer vaccine therapy, and they're able to adjust their RNA vector to incorporate, COVID sequences. And so definitely the cancer community has really been put to work around COVID.
And I really recommend you check out that podcast, and Jeff goes through all the, you know, the basis of it. The paper itself is amazing. They write up all 19 patients in detail. And Lisha, what's going on in MGH? Any interest? Also the issue, you know, passive serum. I mean, we heard some positive things about that. Any comments, Lisha?
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on. I'm not directly involved in these studies, but they're looking at convalescent serum. They're looking at the prevalence in the community of asymptomatic patients. We've got trials of remdesivir. You know, the hydroxychloroquine trials, I think, are wrapping up from what I understand. But I think that there's a lot of creativity collaboration across multidisciplinary groups. You know, our hospital put together, as I'm sure many others across the country did, a specific IRB and a research kind of central hub for COVID-related research. And also a center for innovation around COVID research. So, you know, there's lots of different people coming together to come up with creative solutions for this global problem.
So I'm going to start to get into the effect of this pandemic on the management of cancer patients. And we've seen lots of papers coming out trying to give advice to docs. We want to hear what the two of you have to say as well. I'll just tell you sort of how we kind of got into it. You know, a couple weeks after everything shut down in the middle of March, all the meetings were canceled. We flipped into a virtual mode immediately. One of the first programs we did was on prostate cancer, actually. And there we started immediately hearing, as part of this is a program we were doing on PARP and prostate cancer, but we started hearing immediately from these docs about how they were changing their practice. For example, de novo metastatic prostate cancer, where in the past they would choose between docetaxel and hormone therapy orally, now docetaxel's going all oral therapy. Started to see how it was affecting algorithms. The next week, we did a big lung cancer seminar, and we heard from a couple more people at Hopkins there and started to see how this is actually playing out in practice. We did another webinar similar to this one on CLL and COVID-19, and there one of the issues that came out that I thought was really interesting was the challenge of diagnosing COVID, and we're going to get into that in a second. So we want to talk about managing patients who are not known to have COVID, and there are several things we want to get into. I think Nair already began to talk a little bit about some of the things that are being done in clinics, and I think it's really going on across the country. We want to talk about COVID testing, and then in particular, the issue of using specific anti-cancer therapies, whether or not that changes the risk of developing COVID or complications from it. And then finally, we get into the issue of the effect of all this on algorithms for management of lung cancer. We'll talk about metastatic disease, stage 3 inoperable, and adjuvant treatment. So just to begin, Alicia, can you talk a little bit about, at least at MGH, what your criteria is to do COVID testing, assuming a patient doesn't have any symptoms to suggest COVID? In some parts of the country, we're hearing that patients who are starting systemic therapies will be tested. And let me just ask the audience a couple questions before Alicia responds. So how many patients in your practice, this is for the audience, just click on the answer, how many patients in your practice have either known or suspected COVID and also cancer? So we'll see, you know, we know we have people from all over the country. Alicia, what has your practice been? In some cases, we see people testing for systemic therapy, testing before admission to the hospital for surgery or procedures. What are you doing at MGH?
At MGH, we are testing all patients who are admitted to the hospital because it will have implications about the type of PPE that's used during their care. We're also testing all patients before aerosol-generating procedures are done. So for lung cancer patients, that does include bronchoscopy, and it also includes percutaneous lung biopsies. But for example, for a percutaneous liver biopsy, they do not have to be tested. In the clinic, and as far as delivering therapy, we have the ability to test patients before we start a treatment if we believe that it would be necessary. In the thoracic clinic, we're not really doing that, to be honest, before we start our standard chemotherapy or immune therapy regimens. I believe that my colleagues who are giving more myelosuppressive treatments, maybe in the leukemia lymphoma clinics, are more routinely testing asymptomatic patients before delivering therapy. But for lung cancer patients, we're not doing too much. I will say that the lung cancer patients end up getting a lot of the testing for symptomatic reasons because their tumors have a lot of symptoms that can be confusing or potentially be COVID. So we are testing a lot of our patients with cough, you know, sometimes more than one time to find out if they're positive so that they can be treated and seen in a different area of clinic. We have a specific COVID positive cancer clinic space and infusion space where they're seen if they are positive.
And so we can see here, Lisa, the people who are watching today, more than 80% of them have had a patient with cancer and COVID, and actually about more than a quarter of the audience has had more than four patients. So I don't know if that's civil United States, obviously a very mixed bag across the country. But one other question we want to put out to the audience is about your testing. So we want to ask the audience in general, do you currently test people for COVID if they're asymptomatic? And if they're starting on systemic therapy, do you do it for all systemic new regimens, just for chemotherapy, or you're not testing? Nair, again, what's your approach to testing at Columbia?
I mean, very much similar to, you know, to Alicia. I mean, I think anyone who's, you know, coming in to the hospital, you know, we're testing in anticipation of any treatments, but also for patients who aren't getting treatment, we need to know if they're in the waiting room, what their status is. So patients typically will get seen and temperature checked and sort of screened for symptoms and in the lobby and get tested. And then, you know, we usually get the results back, you know, same day, so we can kind of deal with it accordingly. So, yeah.
So, and it looks in terms of the audience, again, I'm sure this is geographic. It could be interesting to see how people vote in different geographic areas, but 2/3 of the audience isn't doing any testing right now, but you can see the results for the others. So we want to kind of drill into a little bit about actual clinical oncology decision making. But first, before we get into it, Nair, in your presentation that you did that we're going to be posting, you provided a really great overview of sort of kind of the COVID problem. And maybe you could just sort of go through that before we kind of tackle very specific issues, Nair.
Sure. You know, I think as you know, as you mentioned, it's certainly challenging in our lung cancer population where, you know, these, you know, it's a little bit hard to distinguish some of these symptoms that they're having, but certainly many of our patients or majority of their patients, you know, are not having ongoing pulmonary symptoms and so I think any change or new symptoms need to be we aware of, including really anything ranging from cold or fever, or dry cough, and other non-specific signs to actually severe, you know, pneumonia, ARDS, that can occur in a significant number of infected individuals. One of the issues is really the mortality around, you know, COVID in the general population is much lower than the cancer population. So, you know, leading to a lot number of studies looking at the influence of chemotherapy or immunotherapy or other treatments. The problem, I think, in our patients is that we give them drugs which cause lung inflammation. And so immune checkpoint inhibitors, you know, we can see pneumonitis in about 2% of cancer patients. It's probably higher in our lung population, more in the order of sort of 4 to 5% range. And tyrosine kinase inhibitors can also cause a pneumonitis pattern. And so we can see these pulmonary infiltrates, which, you know, unlike immunotherapy where you, you know, stop treatment or hold treatment for somebody who's an immune checkpoint inhibitor pneumonitis, patients who are on tyrosine kinase inhibitors can have these waxing and waning lung inflammation that we don't necessarily stop treatment as long as they're asymptomatic and not deteriorating, but we can see these infiltrates one scan, then a few months later we can scan them again, you know, they may be gone. So it's definitely been an issue on these therapies.
So Leisha, actually we have a case that we're going to talk about. Unfortunately, I'm not sure where Leora is, but hopefully she's okay. But she had a case that she, actually I met with her yesterday on Zoom and she presented. This is a patient she saw in the last week. But first, I'm going to ask the audience how they might think about this clinical situation. So you have a patient with metastatic squamous, presenting with metastatic squamous cell, a TPS of 30, but the patient who's asymptomatic tests positive for COVID. So the question is, what would you do? Would you hold off on treatment and just observe and wait until the COVID, you know, becomes COVID negative? Would you use chemotherapy? Would you use chemotherapy, immunotherapy? Would you use immunotherapy alone? And you know, this really gets into the issue, Leisha, of what we know and particularly what we don't know, I think, about the impact of anti-cancer therapies. Leora's talk that she did for us yesterday that we're posting, you know, went through in voluminous detail, the terrible data, lots of data sets that are out there. I don't know that I've seen a whole lot that's super convincing that there is much of a difference. I mean, you know, globally, it looks like the mortality is higher, but it's kind of hard to affiliate it with any particular cancer treatment, including local therapies. Alicia, is that your impression?
I think it certainly is early days in terms of what we understand. And a lot of the reports that have come out, I think, are also influenced by regional factors that were outside of their cancer treatment, such as ICU bed availability or, you know, different health and age of different populations. So I think we're still a ways from understanding exactly how the treatment that we're going to give to a patient sitting in front of us in clinic may be impacted or may influence their outcome with COVID. I think it's definitely difficult if you have a patient who you have known positive COVID test. You know, a lot of more commonly we're talking about the theoretical chance of COVID in our patients. You know, there's always a chance that the test is not accurate. So, I mean, I think if you have a patient who tests positive, a new diagnosis of cancer, they're not in extremis because of their cancer and could wait a short while, it would be worthwhile to investigate a little more, do a second test, see how they do after a brief period of observation. But ultimately, if they're clinically well, I wouldn't necessarily hold treatment for too long in order to sort that out. But I think we're all still learning.
So it's always interesting when you see a heterogeneity of responses. It looks like in our audience, I'm sure whoever we asked about this case, you're going to see a lot of heterogeneity. So you see everything from just observe the patient to just give chemo, immune, and then both. This is the actual case as it's sort of evolving right now. A 68-year-old patient who was tested positive. He did have initially some symptoms of fatigue, anosmia, but now he's asymptomatic. The patient got retested as it was about to begin treatment with chemo IO and was found to be positive. And she's going to hold off for a little while longer because the patient seems to be stable at this time. Nair, what's your approach to patients? I mean, most of them, as we were saying, do not test positive, but still the concern about the possibility they may develop it. And particularly, Nair, what are your thoughts about chemotherapy? I've heard people say they want to avoid chemo. Of course, everybody wants to avoid infusion, but particularly the issue of neutropenia. Any comments on that, Nair? Any data that we really have on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of data. I mean, some of the data that came out recently in the Lancet last few weeks ago, you know, really suggested that you know, patients did not seem to do, you know, significantly worse if they were, you know, getting treatment versus not. Other areas have shown that if you receive chemotherapy within the last 4 weeks, you can do worse. I mean, I think that, you're giving chemo, which can be myelosuppressive. You're giving steroids, which can, you know, affect your T cells, which are important for, you know, I mean, you have an antibody response to the COVID, but you also need a T cell response to be mounted. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be conservative in what you do. I think if patients, you know, like this, if they have a, you know, significant disease burden and need the chemotherapy, then you don't want to, you know, withhold it if they really need it for treatment of their cancer. But you probably, you know, would want to, you know, give them some dose reduction, maybe avoid the corticosteroids in the treatment regimen if you can. And then this patient, if they had small, you know, modest volume disease, you could envision, trying pembrolizumab alone, which is, you know, approved for, you know, patients who have more than 1%, maybe choose the regimen which you're giving every 6 weeks dosing instead of every 3 weeks to limit coming in. And the other thing, this patient, I mean, you know, he had it 6 weeks ago. I mean, you know, it's a little unusual that he's still, and he's asymptomatic now. One of the cases which I showed you before, Neil, was, you know, a patient who was asymptomatic, had some previous vague fever symptoms a few weeks back, and he was positive, but he also had a very strong antibody positivity. So, it sort of remained positive, sort of an indeterminate level for a couple of weeks after that. And finally, our ID people say his antibody titer is very, very strong. He's probably, you know, okay and safe and not, you know, not infectious, and you don't need to isolate him. So I think that's why you're seeing the sort of diversity of responses. I think that there's a lot to consider for cases like this.
So, Alicia, what about unresectable locally advanced disease? You know, we saw a major advance now in the last couple of years with the addition of IO consolidation with durvalumab. How's your approach to these patients change, both in terms of chemo radiation as well as consolidation durvalumab?
So patients that we're treating with curative intent are the ones that I have tried the hardest to not alter their treatment, or certainly to not put a hold on it. And my radiation oncology colleagues have done the same. It's definitely, when you're going for cure and with locally advanced lung cancer, you know, the odds are still against us, even in the era of durvalumab. So we've got to try everything we can. And when we have data that shows actually delays in treatment, particularly delay in starting the durvalumab, may lead to worse outcomes, you know, we don't want to do anything to worsen outcomes. So one thing I've done with my maintenance durvalumab patients during this time is actually consider the Q4 week dosing, similar to what Nair was mentioning before about Pembro, since that is now FDA approved as part of the small cell frontline regimen. But otherwise, we've tried not to delay.
That's a really good point. So actually, I think I'll ask Nair this one, although of course, Alicia is the one I really want to ask. But Nair, we have a question here for the audience I think might be interesting to consider. So let's just put aside regulatory and reimbursement issues. If we can put the slide up, please. I want to know what adjuvant therapy would you likely recommend today for patients stage 2B adenocarcinoma with EGFR19 mutation? That's an easy one, right? Just, hey, Liora, yay. Awesome.
I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I had faith. I knew you were going to be here. You came in the good part. That's okay. You came in the good part, Liora, which is the, we already talked about your case, incidentally, of the patient who was COVID positive. Did you end up treating him yet, or are you still watching?
No, I'm still waiting for him to be negative. I'm curious what other folks said.
Yeah, well, there was a consensus in the audience, just kidding. They were completely split between observing and treating and what they treated. And I'm not sure we got a consensus out of your colleagues on the faculty, but I was just starting out with Nair, but I think I'm going to flip over to you, Liora, since you're here. We were talking about metastatic disease. We were talking about locally advanced. I want to know about adjuvant. And I imagine the answers to all these questions would vary based on kind of what the situation is COVID-wise in your area. And I know, Liora, of course, your situation in Nashville is, I guess, a lot better than it is, say, in some of the other areas that are seen to be hotspots right now. But Liora, are you still, what are you doing right now for a patient like this who's got an exon 19 mutation? Are you sticking with, we'll put aside reimbursement, chemo? Want to go chemo osimertinib? Wanted to say, hey, let's skip the infusions, reduce your risk of COVID, just go with OC? What do you think, yeah, Liora?
Yeah, I think chemo still has an important role for these patients. And so I would vote for the chemotherapy followed by osimertinib and sort of have that discussion with the patient, kind of like we did with the Pacific data, saying we know it may decrease the risk of the cancer coming back. We're not sure how it's going to impact overall survival, but I don't think that we should not give these patients chemotherapy. I think that chemotherapy is still an important part of their treatment.
And, you know, Alicia, you know, we talked about this, of course, and I talked with Tom Lynch about it also, you know, the fact that we only have disease-free survival now, but of course, wow, what a hit, you know, a hazard rate, I guess, less than 0.2, depending which one you use. I was trying to remember, what's the hazard rate for decreased risk recurrence with chemo? Alicia, I doubt that it's that low.
Yeah, it's about a 5% improvement in cure rate.
But hazard rate-wise, more in the 20%?
0.75, depending on the study.
Right. So anyhow, interestingly, the most common answer of the audience, Alicia, is OC alone.
Yeah.
I assume that, I guess that's related to COVID, but I don't know. Alicia, what are your thoughts? Are you staying with the tried and true chemo and now followed by OC?
I would definitely recommend staying with the tried and true chemo. I'm guessing that some people are favoring osimertinib alone because Dr. Herbst showed a slide at ASCO and post-hoc analysis of patients who did get adjuvant chemo and how they did with OC versus placebo, and patients who didn't get adjuvant chemo and how they did with OC and placebo. And the benefit to osimertinib was seen across both groups, but that doesn't mean that the chemo should be omitted. Certainly for a stage 2 patient, you know, chemotherapy has a long track record, not just for DFS, but for OS. So I would recommend giving chemotherapy first to a patient like this, but I would also strongly recommend giving osimertinib after that.
Actually, I was just flashing on a project we presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting where we asked 25 breast cancer researchers to say, just tell us what numbers you would give to a patient about adding various HER2 regimens on. And just don't tell us what you do. Just tell us what numbers. I love to do that and see what numbers you all would give, you know, best guess about what the long-term impact would be in this situation. And yeah, I just want to bring in one other issue. And Lior, you went through this in detail in your talk. And of course, the Terabolt Registry initiative, which maybe you can just kind of summarize a bit, was an incredible activity that you were very much involved with. And was presented at ACR and ASCO. But maybe you could just sort of summarize in general what we've learned, Leora, about COVID and lung cancer and how it affects prognosis and mortality.
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's been so much conflicting data and, you know, a lot of it is affected by these retrospective reviews as opposed to a lot of prospective data, but it's the best that we have right now. And for Terravolt, what we found specifically to thoracic cancers, so some different data emerging depending on the tumor type. One is that thoracic cancer patients, the mortality is much higher than what we see for the general cancer population. It's around 35%. In the general cancer population, it seems to be less than 20%. We also saw in Terravolt that less of the thoracic cancer patients were admitted to the ICU, and we don't know if some of the factors affecting that have to do with some of the resources and constraints that Europe was facing. You know, the Memorial Sloan Kettering data said that 24% of patients were admitted to ICU, so much higher than the 8% that we saw in Terravolt. The factors that are associated with increased risk of ICU, as well as, more importantly, increased risk of mortality, were older age over 65, an ECOG performance status of 1 or worse. Patients were on chemotherapy or chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Actually, the hazard ratio for patients on TKIs was 0.28. So, and with chemo being sort of the baseline comparator, so much, much lower for patients who are on TKIs. And so, you know, what this has made us think about in terms of treating our patients, you know, I still think we need to treat our patients with the best regimen. So if they should get chemo, they should get chemo IO, that's what we should do. But also a lot of the patients, some of their points of contact were within the healthcare system. It was not what CCC19 indicated was half of those patients got exposed at home. And so can we minimize patients' interactions, specifically with thoracic malignancies, with the healthcare environment? So keep them at home, give pembrolizumab every 6 weeks, give nivolumab once a month, durvalumab once a month, so that we're minimizing how often these patients actually have to come into the healthcare environment.
I guess another issue that's come out is obviously a gigantic one, Lior, and we were chatting about this yesterday, is the issue of telemedicine, and particularly, you know, whether or not it's going, you know, we'll be able to continue getting reimbursement. I know there have been some questions about that in Tennessee, although I can't seem to find any other issues around the country. Lior, any other comments about, you know, ways to minimize risk for patients in terms of not only the choice of therapy, but the procedures that are being used in clinics?
Yeah, so I'm curious if Leisha and I are having the same thing where telemedicine is sort of fading away here and we're being asked to bring our patients back. Also, some states that are rescinding our licenses as of July 8th. So we touched 10 different states here in Tennessee and suddenly those patients are not going to be allowed to do telemedicine. You know, we see some practices, we don't do it, where they're doing weekly labs on lung cancer patients on chemotherapy. That needs to stop. You know, the patients who are getting frequent CT scans, maybe they don't need to get those CT scans as frequently. For many of our patients, especially when they're stable, we're scanning them every 3 months. We're not scanning them every 6 weeks. Also, when they come into the different centers, sort of, is there one place where they get their labs and infusion? A lot of centers will have patients come get their labs on one day, see the doctor, but then they have to come back another day to get their therapy. So I realize that we're spoiled at our institution, but are there some of those things that we can do? And reminding our patients, you know, I have a lot of patients who are suddenly saying they want to fly, they want to go see their grandchildren, that COVID is, the country's opening, but COVID is also opening across the country. And so it is not safe. They still need to be really cautious and stay home and stay away from people. Because their risk factors and their risk of mortality, you know, you get cured, quote unquote, with immunotherapy only to die from COVID, which one could argue in some cases with some of the risky behavior is an avoidable thing for some of these patients.
So I want to talk about some of the cases that have been seen, particularly with COVID, to give a little bit of a flavor to how this is done. Nair, this is a list that you discussed in the lecture that we did together. Can you comment on your clinical experiences, Nair?
Well, I think Leora's point about safety, particularly as there's some surging in states, is really important, because these patients, our patients with lung cancer, do poorly, and there are 6 out of 14 patients that in our group that died from COVID, and some of them were. Most of them were actually not even, the first one was on observation, and on no treatment. Then the second one was on osimertinib. I think that, continuing to maintain that sort of vigilance is really important. And it can get a little bit tricky to figure out what's going on with the patient. This patient was on an EGFR inhibitor trial, with an exon 20 insertion, and he had disease at the right base there, that we were following related to his cancer, and then he had a scan that came up on the right, which showed kind of evolution of changes in that right base, which I think at first blush we thought could be related to his disease progression, but we actually tested him and he was COVID-19 positive at that visit, and so we continued him on protocol therapy, and then a subsequent scan actually showed that area had sort of resolved, and he was back to his baseline scan. So just speaking to, making treatment decisions, when you have changes like this, it makes it harder.
So do you think that was COVID there that localized, sort of, or at least imaging wise localized?
I assume so. I mean, I think.
And did
so.
He have a fever or shortness of breath?
I mean, he always had a cough related to his cancer, so it was a little bit hard to say. I mean, he didn't have any fever. So,
how about this patient?
Yeah, so this one was sort of an unfortunate patient who, in the left chest X-ray, you can see is a large right lower lobe mass, right upper lobe mass, and then he underwent chemotherapy and radiation therapy for stage 3B squamous cell carcinoma. And then he was into about his third durvalumab consolidation treatment, and he developed these bilateral, extensive bilateral pulmonary infiltrates, and did end up dying of pulmonary insufficiency. So, and he was COVID positive. So the question is this COVID? Is this immunotherapy? Is this, how much of this was radiation related? It was a little bit hard for us to put together, but we, certainly treated him with everything we had, but he did expire.
Did he spend time in the ICU? Was he intubated?
He was, yeah.
Leora, in your data, a lot of the initial data was coming out of Italy where they were really overwhelmed. When you look more in the U.S., Leora, what kind of access to ICUs do you see cancer patients having? Are they getting bumped out in areas where there's a lot of COVID?
A little bit hard to know. The CCC19 showed that the percentage of patients who went to ICU, so that was primarily U.S., only 7% of those patients were in Spain, showed that the ICU admission rate was 13%. What we don't know is, were there more patients who met ICU criteria who were not admitted, whereas in Terravolt, we've collected that data of, was ICU indicated, and if it wasn't, why were they not admitted? Some of the data from Terravolt we're looking at now, looking at more of a U.S. population. The only data that we have right now is the Memorial data that was 24%, but there is a bias that we saw with the lung cancer patients, even with a few U.S. centers saying that ICU was not indicated because of stage 4 disease. What was striking with the Terravolt data as well is 75% of those patients had had no therapy or on first-line therapy, and in a disease where we've made such an impact on survival, not having therapy or even being on first-line therapy, which we know can have a good impact on our patients' overall survival. It's really sad to know that such a high percentage of those patients died so early.
So Lisha, in the presentation you put together, you went through a bunch of issues related to the what you see as the effect on patients and patient care, and brought up a lot of really thoughtful points I'd like to get the feedback from the other two faculty members on. So could you kind of go through that?
Sure. I was just reflecting because in Boston, we're a little bit about 6 weeks past our peak. So we're really starting to see how this has affected our patients going through this time period. We talked before about we tried to continue on with treatments as much as we could, but Nair mentioned this too. Many patients opted to delay treatments, office visits, scan biopsies, even if the health system was offering it to them because they were scared to come into the city, scared to, you know, be around other people. And I think that I'm seeing in clinic now some patients with fairly advanced symptomatic presentations that, you know, we probably could have got to them earlier if they were more willing to come in. And then I think we've all seen that therapeutic clinical trials, collection of research samples that go along with trials and lung cancer screening have really been scaled down. You know, my experience, at least with trials, was that sponsors became very flexible and were quite reasonable, I thought, in letting us cut out some procedures related to research and keep the treatment, the key portion, going. But certainly accrual to new studies is down for many reasons, including resources at the hospital and patients willing to travel to tertiary centers to get on scans, to get on studies.
Just to pick up on that for a second, Leora, you know, one of the issues is, you know, with the use of telemedicine, whether or not, you know, in the future, maybe we could see more trial accrual if we used more telemedicine. A lot of patients don't want to go to tertiary centers. Can you do informed consents through telemedicine? Can you execute the process with a local doc? Where do you see that heading, Leora?
I really hope in a positive direction. I think that COVID has shown us that there are a lot of tests and patients on trials that do not need to, you know, that 3-week blood test you have to come in just for your labs, that you have to do at a lab that's certified per the trial. During COVID, we've done those labs locally and the patients are still fine. So I'm hoping that that improves. Studies have allowed patients to get consents done via telehealth. And I hope telehealth comes and stays because it's such a good thing for the patients. And hopefully it will improve in accrual. The problem will be on those, obviously, those trials where the patient needs IV therapy that needs to be administered somewhere. Maybe they have to come, but I'm really hoping that telehealth helps catapult us there. You know, we had similar issues with delayed biopsies or foregoing biopsies. We had patients who were eligible for studies, but they needed a fresh biopsy. And I, as a physician, said, you know what, it's not worth the risk of going into our main hospital when, because, you know, we do have COVID patients here. It's just not a lot. Let's keep you in the part of the clinic where the COVID patients are not. Let's forget about the study and give you standard of care. But hopefully this will also make regulatory agencies and companies realize that this is a good thing for patients. Keep them at home, decrease these unnecessary visits and unnecessary tests.
And, you know, you're thinking back to Nair's patient with the exon 20, you know, a lot of times the trial is the best therapy. We know that, you know, best, that's what I want to be getting, if, you know, in a lot of these situations. Just going back to the MGH situation, back to the slides again, Lisha, you commented about the issue of the fact that, you know, visitors are not allowed in the hospital, not allowed to the clinic, the effect on palliative care, the effect on hospice, the effect on relationships with patients. Any comments, Lisha?
Yeah, one of my palliative care colleagues called COVID-19 the loneliest disease. And it really was patients, especially who were hospitalized and known COVID positive. We were pretty strict about visitors. And one of the hard things about a large number of our patients that were hospitalized is they also didn't speak English. The majority of them spoke Spanish, and we were able to implement some special Spanish language physician teams that would be on the floor. Even if they weren't the primary team taking care of the patient, they would act as a translator, but a medically knowledgeable translator, and really helped some of these cultural, you know, we had these horrible, sad situations where there'd be 5 or 6 members of one extended family all in the hospital on different floors, some of whom were gravely ill or passed away, and trying to help these families navigate this tragedy requires a lot of creative skills.
So Nair was talking about the challenges of diagnosis, and you also brought this up. You were also telling me you felt like the imaging people at MGH were getting really good at diagnosing COVID, and yet I hear from a lot of other people that a lot of times people think it's COVID and it's tumor or whatever. And any comments on these images, Leisha?
Yeah, I think, you know, as with cancer assessments too, you know, radiology comfort with different things can certainly vary from radiologist to radiologist. As an oncologist, I love radiology. I love to go to the film room. My colleagues make fun of me for how much I love radiology. I'm in awe of our MGH radiologists. And I had several experiences where I felt that they really helped the clinical care by bringing COVID into the differential. These are two such cases. So the case on the right is a 47-year-old female with no cancer history, just a healthy young woman who came into our emergency room with cough and shortness of breath and had this chest CT. The overnight radiologist, who was not thoracic specialized, said, oh no, this looks like lung cancer. And that's why I was called first thing in the morning for a consult, a new lung cancer in a 47-year-old woman. When I looked at the scan with a thoracic specialized radiologist, they said, this doesn't look like cancer. This looks like COVID. And she's got a cough and shortness of breath. And sure enough, she was positive for COVID.
What was it that made them think it was COVID? What specifically?
So, you know, I think we're still learning about the patterns that COVID can take on radiographically, but one of the first described kind of classic appearances was, it was just like this scan, kind of a rounded, almost looks like rounded atelectasis or, you know, rounded pneumonia kind of appearance, tends to be in the posterior portions of the lungs along the periphery. So really a textbook appearance, according to them, of what COVID looks like in this 47-year-old woman.
How about the 75-year-old woman
there? Yeah, so the 75-year-old woman is a patient of mine with lung cancer who was diagnosed at the beginning of 2020 with a right upper lobe lung cancer that was causing a lot of obstruction. And so she'd had cough from the day I met her and was in the middle of chemotherapy and getting sicker in March of this year. And I thought, just based on looking at her in the clinic, that her cancer was probably progressing. And so we got restaging scans, and her cancer was relatively stable, which is above the slice I'm showing you here. But she had all these new peripheral rounded ground glass opacities that the radiologist thought looked like COVID, and we tested her and she was positive as well. So
So what treatment was she on at that point, and what did you do about her treatment?
She was on carboplatin and pemetrexed, and we held her treatment. She was quite ill, so you know, she wasn't, even if she'd been negative for COVID, we probably would have held her chemotherapy. She did not need to go into the hospital. I mean, she was in her 70s, so I really thought, unfortunately, the cards were stacked against her. She managed to survive. She's actually doing much better now. But she was ill at home with fevers, cough. We had to get her oxygen at home, in bed essentially for about 6 or 7 weeks.
So Nair, you know, one of the things that came out when we did our program on CLL, and we had actually Anthony Matto from Memorial across the way from you, was talking about the challenge of seeing patients that look like they have COVID but test negative. And you know, these people generally, it sounds like they're getting managed as if they have COVID, I think COVID presumed, so to speak. Have you seen that phenomena where, Nair, where it looked like the patient had COVID and yet tested negative?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's not an uncommon problem for, you know, within our cancer population as well as non-cancer. I mean, I think, remember, these assays were set up, you know, very quickly and, you know, with patients who were gravely ill. And so, you know, the threshold that they use is, you know, could be too high. And so I think that we've definitely had patients who, you know, who, and staff, you know, who I think will know more as we get more and more information on antibody results on people and that may have tested negative but have antibodies now.
So in a second, I would like to also, Lisha, to continue elaborating on some of the impacts she's seen in patient care. But just to go back to you, Leora, I know in our conversations, one of the things you've talked a lot about is the psychosocial impact of this situation, not only on the patients, but the families and the caregivers. Anything that you've seen that's been particularly helpful to try to assist patients sort of navigating their way through this?
Yeah, so I think it's been easier in the outpatient than the inpatient, you know, similar to what Lisha saw. In inpatient now, we allow one family member. Something that we've done a lot, I'm walking around with my iPad, which I never used to do, and we FaceTime a lot of patients. I created a new email just so not everyone has my phone number suddenly. But so if only one, for example, if a patient can only be there with their husband, but their children, they actually have to sit in the car if they've driven here with family members. The family members can't even stay in the lobby. So we'll FaceTime them and we'll bring them into the conversation. I also am spending a lot more time in the evening calling other family members just to kind of keep them up to date. So to let them know what I told their significant other. Because often people will come with two or three visitors and you need those extra set of ears, especially when things are going great. That's all you need, but you need those extra set of ears afterwards. We also have a survey that's live now with TerraVault looking at patients' perspective and what they've experienced with lung cancer so that we can sort of better understand what we need to offer our patients for support as the next wave continues, especially here in the U.S.
Are you aware of any data that looks at sort of what patients have access to? Because that's another issue, Leora. It's all well and good if somebody has a computer and they had to use Zoom and all, but lots of patients don't have computers. They don't have smartphones. What do we know about the ability of patients to access telemedicine?
It's a great question. I can only tell you anecdotally in the South, many of my patients have flip phones. They don't have smartphones. Many of my patients' telehealth visits have turned into phone visits because they can't figure out how to log into the My Health at Vanderbilt app and then connect to Zoom. Many of our patients, if I am seeing them on Zoom, it's because their children are available. So access is a huge issue. Here in the South, it just is a patient thing, especially lung cancer patients are a little bit older. I would imagine in some other parts of the U.S. where there's more lower income families, different socioeconomic status, that will continue to be an issue.
So before I go back to Leisha, I see an interesting question in the chat room, Nair, about the effect of immunotherapy as monotherapy compared to dual immunotherapy. I assume that's ipi-nivo. And of course, all you need to do to get a fight started amongst pulmonary oncologists is say the word ipi-nivo nowadays. But I love hearing about it because I thought it's fascinating. So Nair, first of all, immunologically, let's say single agent monotherapy versus ipi-nivo in terms of immune, you know, problems, immune effects, and where, if at all, would you like to use ipi-nivo nowadays, Nair, if at all?
So in terms of the first question, I mean, I don't think we really know. It hasn't really been extensively tested whether monoimmunotherapy or dual immunotherapy, you know, was going to influence COVID. I mean, there was an analysis that Sloan Kettering did in Cancer Discovery looking at the effects of immunotherapy on you know, in their population. It didn't seem to be deleterious. I mean, the second question in terms of, you know, where we use it, I think that the best data from my perspective is in the PD-L1 zero patients, you know, where we saw, you know, a high degree of activity and a good survival benefit in PD-L1 zero patients. So I think for patients where you may be wanting to spare chemotherapy, but they're PD-L1 zero, I think it seems to be a good option. It doesn't seem to me in the other PD-L1 subgroups to be clearly superior to pembrolizumab monotherapy.
Yeah, and that's where I'm hearing people talk a lot about is PD-L1 zero patients, although you can get the argument in terms of duration of response. So that data looks pretty interesting, but that will be for another time. So, Lisha, you had this slide here that kind of summarizes some of your thoughts about kind of what's been going on the last few months. I'd like you to maybe chat a little bit about that to close here.
Sure. I think I think one of the things that's really hit me recently is how much of an impact this has had on our patients, not merely in terms of cancer treatment, but so many other factors, especially mental health factors. In addition, the effect it's having on the teams, the physicians and other providers that are caring for these patients in a very different setting that used to be team focused and is now, you know, you're much more by yourself or over Zoom with patients. And I think the level of stress, anxiety, depression is high among both the patients and all the providers these days. And so it's a really hard time. But nevertheless, I'm hopeful that my colleagues here on the phone have been some of the leaders in the field as far as improving our understanding of what's going on with COVID. And I think that one thing that we really have to watch for in the future is the larger effects that this period of time has had on our field, both in terms of our patient outcomes as well as our research productivity. I mean, I think the ripple effect is going to go on for quite a few years.
So it kind of seems like hope and faith is kind of hard to come by nowadays, but we in oncology have always been able to meet that challenge and find reason for optimism. Thanks so much to the faculty for joining us today. Thanks to you for attending. Be safe and stay well.